Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Preparing herself to get cracking on the festive cheese board is Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello.
We do record these things. I've worked it out. We often don't have lunch. And then we record them.
Well, that's why we talk about food all the time.
Is this what it is?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm not as obsessed as I may seem.
Really? Do you subscribe to the view you shouldn't shop while hungry?
Well, it depends on whether you're on a budget, because if you're on a budget, that'll go out the window.
Yeah, or on a diet.
Like, oh, that and that and
yeah.
that.
You reckon you should be calm and rational when you're shopping?
I think so. I mean, I think that probably the best thing to do is make a list, isn't it? And stick to it religiously.
You know, since they have delivery of food, I've stopped going to... Do you have the food delivered?
We get a box of vegetables delivered.
Oh, you do that, do
week.
You?
Yeah, from a farm just down the road, and so you just have to cook what you're given.
Yeah, I found that dispiriting, because I just used to throw stuff away.
Oh, no, I'm militant, so we have to use every single...
So you're constantly making, like, okra soup and stuff like
just
that?
Just weird combinations. Like, I cook very differently now to how I cooked a year ago when I didn't do the...
Is there not stuff that you just think, I don't really like that, I don't want
well,
to
you
have?
You can opt out of certain things. But yeah. You end up getting odd ingredients that you wouldn't normally use.
Like
I mean,
what?
I used to cook so many things with tomato and aubergine, which isn't exactly indigenously British,
no.
is it? So now I just having lots of turnip, really, and potato, and cabbage.
Sounds kind of bleak, doesn't it? When you put it that way. I don't know about you, but I've always felt, this is an advert for you, a year's subscription to the TLS would make a lovely Christmas present. So if you're thinking of what to give this year, I would recommend that. And your tweets and emails about where you listen to this podcast, they keep piling in. We do enjoy them, don't we, Thea?
We do.
I've got a couple here. Dale tells us that he tunes in while walking my hound dog Lily in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. As we stand on a footbridge, a great blue heron emerges under our feet, flying upstream above the water. Which is beautifully put. And Sean is in that neck of the woods too. He listens while falling asleep in northwest DC, a mere 3 miles from the White House and its addled, dangerous occupant. It feels like receiving news of the resistance from inside the palace. Thanks for keeping the cultural barricades fortified.
We've also had an email from John Language, who claims to be our highest altitude listener. Have I told you about him?
Yeah, go on.
So he says he listened to the podcast at 3,500 metres in the highlands of Lesotho in South Africa.
So the challenge goes out. So the thing to beat is 3,500 metres. We will take depth, though, as well. So the lowest and highest
listener. What extremes of temperature? I'd be quite interested to hear about those as
I
well.
I think mundane or extreme is really what we're interested in. And Thea, you were interested in Hannah Tame. Of the National Maritime Museum archives. She has tweeted an update. She used to listen while retrieving manuscripts, which is quite a TLS-y thing to do. She's now at the Church of England archives.
I mean, the same question goes. What's going on there, Hannah? Strike up a correspondence.
In the occasional series of what Hannah Tame is doing in the archives.
Various places.
We'll continue to give you updated. Anyway, do keep them coming. This week, we will consider the curious world of Samuel Pepys and John Evelyn, two friends from the 17th century. Thankfully, we have the brilliant Ruth Skerr as a guide. And we will also, in a typically abrupt shift of focus, ponder the whale. Why are we so keen on this killer? Lucy Atkins has some answers.
Thrasher, blackfish, seawolf, killer, demon from hell... These are just some of the names that have been attached to Orcinus orca, the killer whale. In Naturalis Historia, Pliny the Elder described the whale, in what might be the orca's earliest literary outing, as an enormous mass of flesh armed with teeth. In short, the orca has not always been the cuddly black and white cultural icon that it is today, the supposedly gentle giant we fell for example, in 1993's film Free Willy, more on which in a moment. Indeed, according to Lucy Atkins, in her review of Jason M. Colby's book, Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator, the transformation from demon dolphin to friendly orca happened a while before that film. And in just 20 years, in fact, from 1962 to 1982, whole centuries of bad press were undone. How so? And why? Lucy Atkins is here to tell us more. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
So, the story of the orca's transformation, it's not a gradual thing, really. I mean, there's a kind of a pivotal period, this shift in man's relationship with the whale in the 60s. And there are some specific dates to pin the narrative to as well. So let's start with 1964. What happened there?
So in 1964, somebody harpooned an orca, kind of by accident, up in British Columbia, and brought it in. And they decided to try and keep it for a bit. And at that point, everyone thought killer whales were the demon of the sea. They thought they were going to get eaten. And they
so
put there, this...
There was no objection to whale hunting then? There wasn't much of a...
On the contrary, people were sort of encouraged to... Fishermen were encouraged to take out guns and shoot them. And in the Pacific Northwest, we're talking about, the US Navy actually boasted about blowing them up with explosives. And, you know, it was a kind of get the beast.
A bit like we
mentality.
Are with on wolves in on land, that there was a period where people just
annihilate them.
So it was all, it was all about this appalling predator who got in the way of and threatened fishermen and needed to be... macheted or gunned down. And so they brought this whale in and they nicknamed it in a sort of ironic way. They called it Moby Doll. And Moby Doll turned out not to be savage or demonic, but really rather sweet and docile and placid. And they all kind of decided that they quite liked Moby Doll. But unfortunately, Moby Doll then started to get horribly sick because she was being kept in the wrong kind of water.
This was because Ted Griffin, is it, who founded the Seattle Aquarium, he got involved. He kind of spied an opportunity, paid an astonishing amount of money, like $70,000 for...
Not, I believe, for Moby Doll.
So
Ted was down in Seattle. He was setting up an aquarium. He was obsessed with the water. He was one of the first people to have an aqualung. He was into Jacques Cousteau. He was a sort of slightly maverick character. And he was out... I think he was out sort of paddling around or something and met some killer whales and had this moment, this transformative moment where a killer whale went underneath his boat and turned around and looked up at him as it went under and their eyes met. And he saw into the soul of this creature and realised, you know, this isn't a terrible demonic killer. This is something deeply fascinating. And after that, he really wanted one. And then he did manage to get one. I think it was his one was caught by accident. And he took it in and made it an attraction.
Were they known as really clever then? Because the idea of the clever whale, is that's more recent than that.
Yeah, nobody knew anything about them. They thought they were savage and were going to try and kill them. And it was really once, basically Ted and the Moby Doll situation started to... What happened was in sort of business terms, they realised the public was really interested in this massive, great, big thing and would flock to see it. So they were... one eye on the business, thinking we could make an awful lot of money out of this black and white thing, and one eye on sort of trying to, you know, these guys were genuinely really interested. They really wanted to know. Nobody knew anything about them. They were sort of realizing very quickly that you could form a bond, you know, almost like a dog. You could sort of, you know, form a relationship with this animal. So in the early 60s, it kicked off a huge explosion of captures because dollar signs, Ted spent something like, I can't remember what it was, $70,000 getting hold of one, and that proved to be lucrative. So after that, it was a kind of free-for-all in the Pacific Northwest with kind of, I mean, it was the most macho thing you could imagine, these kind of guys going out on
whale
boats with harpoons, and it was like a rodeo at times, you know, this sort of mad, crazed.
But they weren't
lust.
Interested in conserving the species.
They thought there were loads of them at that point. They didn't realise that it was a very limited population. So they didn't realise they were clever. They didn't really know anything about them. The book is really about this situation, which is difficult to write about, because in order to start loving these animals and bonding with them and realizing they're clever and they have amazing societies and they're sophisticated and they're playful and they're loyal, so to understand all of this, the only reason we understand that is that we captured them and stuck them in little awful bathtubs and watched them do tricks. And that's what was happening in the 60s and 70s. They were rounding up animals, trying to capture the babies. It's actually heartbreaking when you sort of look at what they did to these communities, these families of whales. It was absolutely horrendous.
And Jason Colby's quite an interesting person to tell this story because his father was, he worked in orca capture. So presumably he gives a more balanced story of the orca.
I think he does. His father was involved, though not massively, but he did do some of the captures. And this is kind of Jason's ticket in, because the guys like Ted, who were in the at the forefront of the captures, when everyone started falling in love with the whales, these capturing guys became pariahs, that they didn't, nobody wanted to know them. They thought they were evil, you know, they destroyed these families, they killed whales, they tried to hide the fact that they'd killed whales. So they'd had such bad press that none of them really wanted to talk to anyone. And I think because Jason's father was one of them, that gave him a ticket to get in and talk to these people and get them to open up.
It's kind of extraordinary. This is as late as the 60s, which, you know, because presumably people knew dolphins were clever before that point, did they?
I think they were just discovering, actually, at that point, that dolphins were clever.
What were people doing for millennia? I mean, they must have seen
harpooning
these...
them.
Yeah, keeping it at a respectful distance, yes. I imagine.
Maybe it's very hard to look back on it, but the 60s isn't that long ago. That seems that this sort of moment of realisation could possibly have occurred decades before, but maybe not.
I think what's extraordinary is the way that those hundreds of years of fear were overturned in sort of 20 years of capturing them.
Is it also because they were less dangerous, because boats got bigger and safer, and so what was the, how much of a risk is a killer whale to man by the 70s?
Well, I believe they were never that much of a risk.
Oh, really?
The truth of it is they don't really kill people in the wild. There's sort of hard, almost no stories of killer whales killing humans, except when they're kept in hideous conditions and traumatised in captivity, where they do occasionally kill their trainers. There was the movie Blackfish, which famously told the story of one whale and what that whale had been through, and trying to sort of explain why a killer whale might then drown its trainer. That movie had an extraordinary effect on the entire industry, the Sea World industry, multi-billion dollar industry that basically tanked.
So I went to Sea World when I was a kid, when I was probably 8. I mean, it was fine. It was, you know, you go to that show and they jump up for balls and they splash and everyone gets wet.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I mean, I was 8, so I wasn't necessarily ethically well equipped to sort of debate things. But it didn't feel like a very contentious thing. People just went to see it, didn't they? And it was a massive.
No.
SeaWorld in Florida is a. Well, it was. Is it out of business yet?
No, it's not out of business, but they've been forced to shut down their orca breeding program and phase out their captive orca displays.
What are they going to have then?
Well, quite. They have been facing a lot of trouble. People have been resigning and they've lost tons of money because of Blackfish. And there's actually a sort of effect called the Blackfish effect, which is now studied in universities and things, because it was such a kind of massive and dramatic effect on the public consciousness, where people went from, as we did in the sort of 70s as kids, looking at these beautiful whales jumping out of the water and thinking how cute, went from that to realising, God, you know, these animals have been tormented, and it's the equivalent of putting a human in a bathtub and leaving it there for the rest of your life.
But that hasn't happened with zoos, has it, in the same way? I mean, I know people say zoos are horrible, and I kind of think they're horrible, but has the Blackfish effect happened on zoos, or do we just sort of put up with them?
Well, maybe what it would take is for somebody to kind of look at a specific lion and see what that lion has been through. I mean, I think that's what happened, really, with Blackfish, was they named, you know, the individual. It was about an individual.
Yeah.
And once you connect with an individual, you see everything completely differently.
Which is sort of what happened with the whole Free Willy story as well, because that film made this whale a star, and the film was all about saving the whale. I mean, it's all in the name.
Saving it from what? Because I've seen that film.
From captivity.
So from a SeaWorld type thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Why did that not have the same effect then?
Well, it sort of did. It didn't have as much of an effect as Blackfish, though it did have a big effect, because Jason Colby's pretty good, actually, at bringing out these crazy contradictions, because Free Willy could only have been made because they were using a captive whale. I think it was called
Kaiko.
So they're using this poor captive whale who's stuck in a horrendous sea park in Mexico, and they're using all the trainers who have trained this whale, and that's how the film was made. They were filming Kaiko doing tricks. But of course, the whole thrust of the film was this poor whale has been kept in terrible conditions. And then, after that, Free Willy made a massive amount of money in the box office, there was a big public campaign to free Keiko. And that did happen.
Michael Jackson got involved.
Michael Jackson did. Brilliantly missing the point and saying he would pay for Keiko to be freed if Keiko could come and stay at Neverland.
Oh, that's brilliant.
But then, yes, so Keiko was actually, eventually, there was a big campaign and he was originally captured from Iceland and he was then taken back to Iceland and released. And the real whale experts were saying, you know, he may look fantastic and cute to us, but to other whales, he's a loner, he's a loser with a skin condition.
And
the poor creature was kind of, you know, after a lifetime captivity, set out free in the Icelandic waters and basically sort of languished around, ended up in Norway socialising with the humans who'd come to see Free Willy, and then he died of, I think, pneumonia or starvation. It was just a nightmare.
Oh, my God. None of this reflects very well on any of the people attached to it, does it?
Well, no, it really doesn't. I mean, I think that's the really interesting thing I found about this book, was that Jason Colby he's very keen to portray these whale capturers, understandably, as whale lovers. You know, these people are obsessed with these animals and they adore them. And he does a lot of sort of talking about that. And yet, you read it and you think, well, actually, you know, these guys were ripping one-year-old babies from their screaming mothers and harpooning people. You know, it just sort of feels like it can't be that simple. Like, there must have been an element of, like, dollar signs in these guys' eyes motivating some pretty horrific behaviour. So I'm not really sure how it's possible to hold those two things inside you at the same time, and a sort of adoration and reverence for an animal whilst you're rounding it up and ripping it from its societies.
It's amazing that the aesthetic of it came so late. Maybe it's a bit like, you know, no one looked at the Alps until the 18th century and said, oh, that's an amazing view.
Yeah.
And they just sort of head down and walk past it. And then there's suddenly a cultural awakening. They look pretty. When you see a killer whale, the black and the white, and they're huge and they're sinuous in their movements, they seem beautiful. But isn't it strange there was no awakening to that until a certain point?
Well, I think the thing is, probably, when you see them in the wild, I don't know, have you been...
Well, I've not been whale spotting, no.
So, yeah, well, I've been, and you basically, most of the time, you just see, it's just kind of, they're quite far off, and there's just
splash
some
in
fins.
The
And presumably, if you were a fisherman, you would be trying to avoid them generally. So it's possible that, generally, the public didn't... I mean, that's actually what Jason's arguing, is that the public never actually got to see how beautiful they were, because they were always out there being shot by fishermen. And it was once we started to see them in captivity and realise how beautiful they were that they caught hold of the public imagination, and we began to love them and revere them.
On a kind of final point, what's the prognosis? I mean, how many whales are still in captivity now? I think the oldest one is Lolita, who you mentioned in your piece.
Lolita,
I know.
Jesus Christ. Lolita, the old whale.
And she is pretty old. I hope she's still alive. I haven't checked since I wrote this. I wrote this a few months ago. She's pretty old. She's in Miami. And the heartbreaking thing about Lolita is they've done research, because they've established that killer whales have dialects, that pods have dialects. And they've done things like play her the dialect. They know exactly who her family is, you know, who her mother is, her siblings. They've played her the dialect, and she has responded in her tank in a very marked way to this dialect. And there's big campaigns to release her. But I don't actually know
we don't know that it wouldn't be the same as it is with Keiko, where he was sort of ostracised. Yes. He didn't have the social skills to
could be completely
pick
misguided.
Up the relationship.
But ultimately, presumably, that we must be moving towards a time, maybe post-Blackfish, that the only places that whales will be kept is for preservation and to keep a species alive, not for leaping around. Does that feel like that's the kind of moment we've got to?
But possibly. I mean, I think there's about 70 of them around the world still in captivity. And obviously what all the experts want is for us to start campaigning heavily to stop the pollution that is killing them. Because what's actually happening now in the Pacific Northwest is that the populations are really declining because of horrendous pollution, noise pollution, and particularly
depletion of
Chinook salmon stocks. So they're really declining, and it's pretty desperate, even though they're an endangered species, it's pretty desperate. So that's what needs to happen, really, is that...
You're not bringing a lot of cheer here, Lucy. But we should
well,
not, none of us...
we haven't really talked about how amazing they are, but they are incredible. They're matriarchal, for a start, which is always good. And
I
they
say
are,
in a room of two women. Yes, I quite agree.
They babysit for each other. They have rituals and parties, and they're incredibly sociable and playful and wonderful.
They have parties?
Yeah, they kind of get together and have a knees up.
Do they sing?
They call to each other in a wide variety of different ways. I don't know whether...
Can you give us some of that now?
Would you like me to try? Yeah. I could try. I did spend a lot of time looking at orca cams. You can look at an orca cam, which is set up in the Pacific Northwest, where basically you just sit and look at a grainy screen for hours, and then eventually like one might go past. It's very exciting.
I
hope people listening, that's a good thing we can do, is just appreciate them a little bit more.
Appreciate them, yes.
And don't go to SeaWorld.
And don't go to SeaWorld, definitely.
That's a good lesson. Lucy Atkins, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, thank you for having me.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Now, we've all heard of Samuel Ansotabed Pepys, the diarist, the survivor of the Great Fire of London, a rogerer and a roisterer, although perhaps with a more unpleasant side than those terms might suggest. John Evelyn was a diarist, of course, but he's been largely overshadowed by his peer. He was also a translator, a political writer, and a keen gardener. A new biography by John Dixon Hunt has now appeared, its very title, A Life of Domesticity, as subdued as its subject's reputation. Evelyn and Pepys were friends as well as contemporaries, and Margaret Wills has written a book about them called The Curious World of Samuel Pepys and John Evelyn. To talk us through the two men's similarities and differences is the TLS's very own life writer, Ruth Skerr, author of the formidable biography of another man of the age, who we might get to, John Aubrey. She's on the line now. Hello, Ruth.
Hi, Sig.
Right, why has everyone heard of Pepys's diary and not Evelyn's?
Well, the diaries are very different in tone and composition, and much of Evelyn's is retrospective. It's deeply religious. He does record interesting events, some of them really memorable, like the first tasting of the pineapple at court or Nell Gwynn leaning over a garden wall to flirt with Charles II. But the tone throughout is quite formal and to the point, whereas Pepys's diary is much more vivid and contemporaneous. Some of it written in code, very intimate. It's full of gossip and indiscretion. So I'd say it's easy to see why people find Pepys more accessible than Evelyn.
What was Evelyn doing it for? So Pepys was presumably doing it for his own amusement, partially. Or...
Well, Pepys only kept his diary for a decade. No, it's an interesting question as to why Pepys was keeping the diary. And Evelyn actually wrote, I mean, it's almost like autobiography. It's retrospective. It covers the whole of his life, and there's only when you get to a certain point that he's actually recording events as they happen.
Is it for posterity?
I think so. Evelyn's not writing in code. I think it's a journal, a record of events, people he's seen. He also has an account of the Fire of London in there, so you do see the society and the politics through him, just as you do through Pepys, but they're very, very different in tone.
We had a piece, I don't know if you remember this in the paper, relatively recently, with the headline Samuel Creeps, which is it's about a book called him Society's First Sex Offender. Is this an example of us trying to judge him by the standards of our day rather than his, or was he always, I mean, is he fair dinkum a terrible man?
Well, I doubt he was the first sex offender, and certainly wasn't the only one. But the TLS reviewer Roberta Klimt pointed out that all the information about Pepys's sexual indiscretions comes from Pepys's own diary. And that's an interesting fact in itself. As we were saying, you know, what were his intentions for the diary? Did he want later generations to know that he couldn't keep his hands to himself or his cock in his trousers? Who was the diary for? But also we have to ask, what do we as readers want from the diary? And again, the TLS reviewer pointed out that if we're going to excuse Pepys on grounds that he lived a long time ago when sexual customs and manners were very different from our own, then we have to think about that too. You know, who gets a retrospective pardon and why? I was looking back through the TLS archive and I found a wonderful review from 1998 by Lyndall Roper of a book about women's experience in early modern England. And she describes in the review how Pepys's wife Elizabeth wrote her own account of their tempestuous marriage, and Pepys tore it up in front of her when she refused to destroy it herself. Now, I'd say that was pretty terrible, but it doesn't mean we should tear up and stop reading Pepys's diary. Obviously not.
Do you think his standards are kind of, his behaviour would be bad by any normative moral standards rather than trying to make it time specific? Would he have been ashamed of what he did, or was that actually just what you did if you were a man in his position?
I think at that level I can't say, but I do, I mean, he does write in code, yeah, in the diary those experiences, and certainly, I mean, I think there are elements of shame. The author of one of the books that I've reviewed, Margaret Willis, she talks about the double standards he had for wealthy women and for women who he saw as belonging to a social class below him, domestic servants, etc. It's a complicated set of mores for the time. And I think, I don't believe that we can't say, well, this was an imposition of power on women of the time. Of course we can say that. It doesn't excuse it if everybody else is doing it. But I think we also have to recognise that it's a world away from what we would understand.
And I suppose in a sense as well, we would have an idea of how Pepys felt about what he was getting up to and whether it was just sort of normal and therefore he wouldn't, you know, he would just write it to document it for himself, or whether he was bragging about it socially. We might get that from John Evelyn, perhaps. I mean, was Evelyn aware of Pepys's philandering?
Almost certainly not. I mean, Evelyn is such a different character, and I find it impossible to imagine that they sat down over a pint to discuss what Pepys had been up to. No, absolutely not. I think their interests were in very different...
Apparently Pepys found Evelyn absolutely hilarious.
Well, yes, but...
Well, tell us about Evelyn. Would many people know who he is these days?
Well, I think his diary is absolutely wonderful. I mean, if you're interested in gardening, then you know a lot about Evelyn. If you're interested in very early environmental awareness, then you know about Evelyn.
You make a very large claim about his gardening book, Ruth.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. Yeah. But, I mean, this is how very, very different Evelyn is. I mean, Evelyn had a very calm marriage, you know, 60 years worth of it. And at one point, he became infatuated with a younger woman at the court. And he cast that friendship in completely spiritual terms. Now, it still annoyed his wife, but no one would have believed then or now that some kind of physical affair was taking place. I mean, Evelyn was the kind of person who worried that he was sinning against God by being so proud of his house and garden. And
but isn't that exactly the sort of person that behind the curtains is doing something horrific?
No, I don't think so. Not not in Evelyn's own terms. I really don't. I mean, I think...
You know, that's always a quiet guy, very moralistic, you know, man of God. They're the people you've got to watch out for.
No. When the Everyman...
You're not having this, are you, Ruth?
I'm not having it.
Me tainting Evelyn.
Sorry. When I reviewed for the TLS the Everyman edition of the diary, Evelyn's diary, when it came out, and Roy Strong wrote an introduction, and he said in that one of the things, the real barriers to understanding Evelyn for us is his piety, is the way that religion is completely infused through his life and his sensibility. And I think that's right.
My problem is that as soon as you say someone is pious, I mean, it has a modern connotation which is not positive. Even if you remove that, as soon as you say that is a pious man, I'm immediately suspicious. I immediately think it's a front. It must be a front for something.
Well, I think that might be projecting backwards. Evelyn, for example, his passion for gardening is that he thinks God was the first gardener. He's really, really does run through all of his life, which I think we have to accept that that might be okay. hard to access.
Let's talk about Evelyn then as a gardener, as an environmentalist. Mm. Slightly an aside here, do we owe him for the green belt around London, or if I misunderstood
that? Well, he would be delighted about it. He wanted that. But I mean, also, he knew in his time what we're very concerned with now, which is, you know, people are being made seriously, seriously ill by the quality of the air. And he really wanted to try and raise awareness of that, to stop people cutting down the trees because that was going to make the situation worse. I mean, he had all sorts of really innovative ideas.
He was very aware of the degeneration of soil, wasn't he?
Mm, absolutely, because he's gardening on the banks of the Thames in the mini ice age. So that's very hard to do. And he travelled in Italy, and he wants to bring lots of those Italian gardening ideas back, and is trying to achieve this on the banks of the Thames. And there's this wonderful time, you know, he has to go to the Royal Society and explain what this severe winter has done in his garden to his box hedges, etc.
I mean, presumably that's a London problem rather than a problem in many other places, that presumably once you got out of London, it was all still subsistency.
Evelyn was very well. So Wootton, and okay, it's not very far away, but it was called Wootton House after the trees surrounding it. And when he finally inherited it, because he was the second son, not the first, he was really dismayed to see how much deforestation had taken place. And he said, it's almost denuded, you know, it doesn't deserve its name. And he immediately starts replanting them, because, of course, it's a great naval power at England at that time. So they're cutting down the trees in order to make the ship.
OK, let's talk about your claim, Ruth.
Yeah, about the book.
The book Elysium Britannicum, which I think we've all read, according to you, will remain relevant while much else has become dust.
Yes, well, this is wishful thinking on my part, perhaps. However, one of the reasons I think it's so important is that I actually think it's much more than a book. It's this huge archive. It's a vast compilation of information about gardening that Evelyn collected, going right back through literature, through his own experience, his understanding of Europe and gardening in the ancient world, through the text, and he was constantly adding to it. And so in that sense, there is a published edition of it. It's a very difficult thing to actually publish, which is another reason why some scholars think, you know, Evelyn's never been accorded his proper place in the history of gardening. But it's there in the British Library, and it is an absolutely phenomenal collection of information.
It's like a commonplace book of nature.
Yeah, you could see it like that. Evelyn, it can be a bit chaotic, there's no doubt about that. He keeps on throughout his lifetime adding and adding and adding to it and trying to reorganise parts of it. So it's there almost like a kind of paper museum, but on the subject of horticulture.
And where does Aubrey fit into this? Because you are, of course, the great Aubrey figure.
Well, Aubrey worked in a similar way. So some of Aubrey's texts are exactly like that. The Monumenta Britannica is another paper archive. That one's, you know, all about the ancient stones and remains in Britain. And like Evelyn, Aubrey keeps on adding to it. And wonderfully, Evelyn comments on Aubrey's perambulation when he walks around Surrey collecting up information. He sends the manuscript to Evelyn, and Evelyn generously comments throughout. So they're working together to collect up that information and make sure it's recorded for the future.
So is there a kind of a buddy movie that could be written about Pepys, Aubrey and Evelyn?
I suppose so. Yes.
Are you the woman to write it, Ruth Sker?
I think quite possibly not. No, I mean, you know,
I quite like the idea of that, don't you?
I'd certainly watch it.
Yeah, you can imagine Pepys and, you know, there's this dark side to Pepys, and there's Aubrey and Evelyn sort of talking, wandering around beautiful environmental concerns, I think.
Yeah. It's a tough sell, I would say.
Well, I learned from Ruth's thing that Anthony Pohl wrote a biography of John Aubrey and his friends. So he's kind of done a buddy. There's a buddy text that we could go off.
Yes, so you'd look into all of the environmental anxieties very now, obviously.
Very
suppose.
Now, yeah, Me Too. I mean, a bit of Me Too, bit of climate change.
Yeah.
Am I talking into this at all, Ruth?
No, I'm sorry not to. No, I think it's really fascinating to think about who are the peeps in Evelyn of our time? I mean, who's going to
no
be...
One. It's yeah? all ruined, is it? Because no one keeps a diary anymore, do they? Everyone, we could hear the Facebook accounts of a bunch of show-offs. Maybe that would be the equivalent in our time. You know, the Facebook transcripts of three famous show-offs. Does that sound tempting to
you? Pretty gloomy note to end the year on, isn't
it? It's a gloomy note. But we've talked about this before, haven't we, that biography as a whole is based on private correspondence, diaries, mm-hmm. and the like, which are effectively no longer a feature of the modern world. Mm. And it does beg a question that what would that look like in the modern world? And I don't know what the answer is. It's quite gloomy, isn't it?
I don't know. We'll see, won't we? I mean, I think the impulse to put experience into words and to try and put them in a form where that lasts and outlives the life of the person writing us is very, very deep, very, very strong. So it might have to change genre, change the technologies or whatever the mediums through which we do that. I mean, we have this Pepys diary because of Evelyn persuading him, you've got to make provision for your library and therefore the manuscripts as well and the diary after your death. And Pepys did that absolutely brilliantly. Evelyn, unfortunately, didn't take his own advice. So Evelyn's books have been dispersed. They've been sold by his descendants who wanted money. Whereas Pepys's library is all there in Magdalen College, an amazing collection of music and even the bookcases he designed to have his books and his papers stored in are all there.
You're striking an optimistic note. You think it's not the end of days. The civilization will persist.
I hope so.
I would say thank God that you, Ruth, are our consultant life writing editor rather than Stig.
Look, I've just come up with what I think is a winning modern buddy movie.
The buddy movie.
Which I think seems to tick all sorts of all sorts of contemporary boxes. And I expected Ruth Scurr as our life writer and person who likes to animate and energise this period would have been all on board, but no.
Yeah. Okay. Look, Stig, I'll give it some thought.
Yeah. I accept that promise, Ruth. Thank you very much. Ruth
Scurr, okay, thank you.
I'm serious, no.
I mean, maybe.
All right.
I'm still enjoying the there being some irony in John Evelyn's book, a book about the importance of preserving trees.
in a paper book, yeah. It's like people who go on planes to talk about climate change, isn't
it?
I presume there must be some things you just have to accept and move on from. Otherwise, you'd be so immured by fear of being too ironic. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Ruth Scurr and Lucy Atkins. Make sure you are subscribing to the TLS because we've got some corking editions coming up. Next week's our Christmas special, which includes Dave Eggers, Mick Jagger, turkey dinners, arts of the year and more. And we'll be talking about it on this podcast with a whole disreputable cast of TLS editors. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.